Hi, this is Amy Fioretto from Adams Litter PR, and you're listening to my chapter of As the Story Goes.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man being realistic.
As the story grows.
My name is Trav. I had to get out here on the back porch. Probably hear a little bit of wind in the background, but my kids have fallen down a Pee Wee Herman, Pee Wee's Playhouse rabbit hole on Netflix. I had to get out of the house because it's very noisy. But anyway, talking to Amy Sciaretto of Adam Splitter PR and everything else this week. I'm happy to be able to have her come to the show and take the time out of her ridiculously busy schedule. I say that a lot about a lot of my guests. I somehow find a way to get them for 90 minutes, but I'm very blessed to have gotten an opportunity to talk to her. And wanted to, coming into this, coming out of this, play a little bit of an old Killswitch Engage song. Amy's heavily involved with Killswitch, so I haven't listened to this song in a long time, so I'm playing End of Heartache for you a little bit. Also, as always, thanks to all my Patreon folks. Appreciate the support. And I don't know what to say. I don't know how to address it, but I just felt like I felt led to say something. Thoughts and prayers, positive vibes, whatever y'all are into. But my heart goes out to what happened in Orlando. Last I heard, 20 dead, 42 went to the hospital. Largest mass shooting in American history. Way to go, America. Something else to be proud of ourselves, right? Really broke my heart. This weekend I was married for 16 years, just celebrating my anniversary. And purposely set a lot of time aside to hang out with my wife and kids and my dog. And it's deafening sometimes when you think about how... Man, there's 20 folks that aren't going home to their family. And don't take this stuff lightly. It's just, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I just felt led to say something. But my heart's really broken about what happened there, and it's a shame. So, anyway. Coming out of that, let's flip this over to Amy. Have some funny stories in here. Stick around in the end to hear a pretty funny Glenn Danzig story. I think it's one of my favorite moments. I don't know why. It's not a long story. It just really struck me as funny. But happy to bring it to you, and thanks for listening.
We'll be right back.
We're good to go. We're recording now.
Okay.
All right. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Let's see. We're 38 minutes in trying to get our technological psychobabble to work, right? So we have to hurry. We have to hurry now. We've lost 38 minutes. So anyway, it's been nice having you on the show, and we're going to have to go to commercial. No, I'm kidding. Amy, thanks for coming on. You are maddeningly busy looking at the Atom Splitter website. This is bananas. What is wrong with you? Do you just absolutely want not a minute to yourself, right?
It's kind of shakes out like that. Yes. I do like quiet time. I try to get that on weekends with, I volunteer at a dog shelter, and that's my decompression time. But during the week, there's not a lot of free time and not doing stuff involving work and band.
I saw that. I saw your Twitter feed was actually pretty awesome, because I just followed you earlier today because I was like, I gotta get on the stick here and start doing my research. And, I thought this is just going to be another rock star promotional, look who I know, look who I work with, everything. And your Twitter feed is just like dog, 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 dog. So, Seth has actually met your dog and speaks very highly. Your dog has a unique
fur baby. Yep.
Yeah. I'm supposed to ask you about his name.
Oh, his full name. He's an English bulldog, and I had to give him a proper English name to suit his breed. And I always like the name Higgins. And people always say to me, Higgins, like Magnum P.I.? And I'm like,
Magnum P.I., right?
No, I'm like, not Magnum P.I. I'm like, don't you guys read? Is anybody literate? Has anybody ever read Pygmalion? It's My Fair Lady, Henry Higgins, who, you know, pretty much, you know, kind of, you know, charmed and helped Eliza Doolittle bring out who she was. And Henry Higgins, it's a big name for, he's a big dog. He's 57 pounds, but he's a bulldog. He's very stocky. But his full name, I knew that I had to give him a metal name as well, not just an English name. So I wanted to name him after my favorite metal singer, which is Phil Anselmo from Pantera. So his full name on his AKC papers, registered with the AKC, his full name is Higgins Hansen Anselmo /Chiaretto. So he has a very full name. That's what he is known as when people send him cards for his birthday. That's what the cards say, because that's his full name.
Amazing.
Yeah,
we
HHAS.
We got a Lhasa Apso going on 2 years ago. We rescued her, which is makes it sound like I ran into a burning building or something. But
no, but rescue work is very important.
Yep, we got her, and everybody said they liked the name Grace, so we can call her Gracie. And I said, one condition: we tell everybody that we named her Grace after the State of Grace song from Hot Water Music. And my wife was like, okay, fine. And what's the second stipulation? I said, her middle name is Jones. So my dog's name is Grace Jones Turner. Yep.
That's amazing.
Yeah, everybody hates that. I think it's awesome.
No, he had to have a metal name. And I told Phil Anselmo, I interviewed him for something, maybe Noise Creep, his manager's like, you got to tell Phil about Higgins' name. And I was like, all right. So towards the end, when I told him, am I allowed to curse?
Oh, I recommend it.
Okay, good. I don't have to get the obligatory swearing out. So when I was telling Phil about it, we were talking. I said, oh, I just want to tell you something. I said, you know, I have a dog, and I gave him the story about needing an English name because he's an English bulldog. I said, but I had to give him a middle name, so I named him after you. And when I told him, I said his name is Higgins Hansen Anselmo Chiaretto, and Hansen with an E, he was like, that's fucking cool.
Yeah.
So I felt like we had the stamp of approval, because Phil is kind of by osmosis Higgins' father.
That's about as excited as he gets, too.
Yes, he was just like, that's fucking cool. And I was like,
yeah, hey. And in that low, completely baritone, I've blown my throat out of my own body voice of his, yeah.
Yes, exactly. But like I said, I have the proof. I have the AKC papers. He's registered. That's his full name. And it's, you know, it's on his, like, everything that I have that's his legal papers that has that name on it.
That's awesome. I love it. We covered the bulldog already. That's fantastic.
Yeah, he's the best dog ever.
Before we get into the music thing, I have to cover one thing with you, because I finally get to talk to another Phillies fan.
Oh, goodness. Yes.
Ryan Howard got benched today.
You know, I thought they were going to cut him. They were talking about it on the Fanatic the other day when I was on Saturday. I was listening, and they were just saying it's time to just let him go. I mean, he's a relic from an era long gone, and he hasn't been good in years. And, you know, if we don't have Chase Utley anymore, I feel like it's really time to close the door and close the book on that whole period.
Yeah, between at least this year, whether they don't cut him or and complete the year, whether they do cut him, Chooch and Howard ain't coming back.
Yeah, it's time. I mean, they kept Rollins too long. And I hate to say it, they kept Utley too long. They kept a lot of those guys way too long. And I'll never, you know, getting rid of Cliff Lee when we could have had Cliff Lee and Roy Halladay and in that season together, that was the biggest mistake Ruben Amaro ever made. And I don't think that it's going to take them years to recover from that. And it was very difficult for me to see, you know, Chase Utley, seeing him in blue hitting grand slams and people still throwing behind him. Like, you know, he's always going to be a Philly, but I just hope he hurries up and retires, because I don't like seeing him in blue.
No, it's painful.
It is.
I don't like it either. I don't watch it. I can't see it.
I shared on Facebook the other day that grand slam, just because, you know, because I miss him. But other than that, I don't like seeing him, you know, in another uniform.
I missed him too. Utley was like, second base was like my favorite position. And he was like, he became one of my favorite players since like Mike Schmidt, since I was a kid.
I'll always love the fact that he said what everybody was thinking when he said world fucking champions. That entire city and every Phillies fan felt the same way.
World champions. World fucking champions.
He just had the balls to say it.
Yep. It was inappropriate. There were children there. Come on.
Please. I would have said it. I don't care if I had 100 kids. They would have all said world fucking champions too.
I would have let my kids say that day.
Yes, me too.
All right, let's dig into this. Mutual friends through Seth Werkheiser. He told me that he says he has a lot of respect for you because the way you got started was... Well, the way you got started, you can go back earlier than this and tell us what it was like to get you into music and, you know, where it all started and what album it was, blah, 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 blah. But your first job was just too friggin' far of a commute. Like, people don't travel that far, and you did.
Oh, my first job at CMJ, yeah, back
CMJ,
in 1998,
right.
I was living in Rutherford, New Jersey, and I had to take the New Jersey Transit bus to the Port Authority, which is on 42nd and 8th in Manhattan. Then I would, depending on the weather and depending on what time it was, I would either have to take the subway 10 or 12 blocks to Penn Station, or I would have to run down 8th Avenue, you know, fighting other commuters to get the Long Island Railroad at Penn Station. And then I would take the Long Island Railroad all the way out through Queens to Great Neck, Long Island. And usually I would leave my house by 7:30 and usually be at my desk by 10 o'clock. And it cost me, at the time, this was a lot of money, $217 a month to get to work, sometimes a little bit more because if I had to take the subway. So you could say give or take $230. And what I was making was like pretty much like, you know, very, very, you know, low wage. So I was spending a significant chunk of my salary getting to work every day. But I loved the job so much that I would have, you know, it was the best job I ever had. It was my favorite job that I ever had.
That's insane. 2.5 hour commute. And it isn't like... in a car either. It was like jumping,
it was all
jumping
public
here
transit, you know, so I always noticed myself getting colds. But I actually became, you know, at that time I didn't have cable. I lived on the third floor of a house, you know, in Rutherford. So instead of going home and just having, you know, ABC, NBC, and CBS channels, or as I grew up, 3, 6, and 10, instead of having those, a coworker who became my roommate, who I lived with for 10 years, my friend Brad, we would just go, you know, explore the city. We'd go down to St. Mark's. We would go, you know, to Bleecker Street. We'd go to record stores. You know, we just explored the city because it was better than going home and, you know, sitting in, you know, in my house and watching news magazines like 60 Minutes because it was the only TV I had.
Right. How'd you get started in that gig then? If it was, you had to have been... I mean, you weren't like aiming to be a barista somewhere and wound up with that job.
I knew I wanted that job. Like, I knew I used to sit. I worked at my college radio station. I was the program director and the music director at my college station. I went to Rutgers in New Jersey. And I was also the music editor of the school paper. And I interned at a magazine called FMQB, which was a trade magazine for radio. So I interned there and I was writing reviews. And I was also writing for Rockpile, which was a local music magazine. And I also wrote for Juice, which was a national skate and surf and music magazine. And I was just always going and trying to go to New York City to go to shows, and before I graduated, you know, I spent, you know, all my friends are partying. You know, I would go to Kinko's at the time before it was FedEx Kinko's. And I just made like a press kit on myself. And I included a bunch of stuff that I had written, you know, a bunch of published reviews. And I put a press release out on myself that said, I'm graduating college and I think you should hire me. You know, so I was showing that I wanted to do press or like publicity at a record label, or I wanted to work at a magazine. And when I was at my college radio station, I used to read CMJ reviews. And I remember I used to be like, oh, I could write these and I could write these better. And they were one of the first places to get back to me for an interview because they had an editorial assistant position too opening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went and before I even graduated college, I had two interviews there. And I remember they made me wait all summer. And I remember when I came back for a second interview, there was a stack of resumes taller than I was. And I wound up just kept staying on them. I'm like, listen, I've got two other jobs. And I did have other job offers and interviews to go do like radio promotion and other stuff. And I called CMJ. I said, listen, I need to know by the end of the day if I have this job or not, because I'm going to take another job. And they hired me. They called me back and they offered me the job. And I remember my boss at the time, his name was Glenn Sansone, told me he felt like he was like giving away the prize on The Price is Right, because I was so happy when they told me that they wanted to offer me the job. You know, and I knew I wanted to work there, and I had a bunch of other possible opportunities, and that was the one I wanted, and I waited for it, and I pushed for it, and got it. You know, and that job really was a springboard for me, and it, you know, I started out as an editorial assistant writing some reviews, and then you know, they bumped me up 3 months later and they gave me the metal section as my own. And I grew it from one page and one chart to 5 pages and 2 charts in a year's time. So that was like a very big source of pride for me.
Now, how does that work? Like explain this to me like I'm dumb. So like if you talk to me like I'm a 6-year-old, like, what do you mean you grew it? Like, I understand when you grew it, it got bigger. Duh. I mean, like, how do you get permission to make it bigger? Like, you had to get feedback, and like people had to retaliate to it.
It was a trade publication. CMJ was College Music Journal. It was a trade publication, and it mm-hmm. used to take airplay. I used to have to hand enter the airplay from 250 radio stations every Monday and Tuesday. Then I would run the charts, and then it was just the CMJ. That's when metal radio and CMJ and college radio and commercial specialty airplay was really a driver of sales. So I used to run the charts, and I would, you know, and I would write the column, and then it became the most popular column in the magazine because I turned the column into a girl about town thing. Oh, I saw this band Kitty. You know, I gave Kitty their first piece of national press in CMJ, and I have a gold record on the wall because of it. I was the mm-hmm. first national U.S. writer to write about them in CMJ, and, you know, I think I saw Stained in every single venue, from like the Wetlands to the Bowery Ballroom to Mercury Lounge to, you know, Coney Island High. And I was always writing about them as well. And I remember like their publicist was like, oh, that CMJ review you did gave me such mileage. So she would always hook me up anytime Pantera played, anytime Metallica played. They would always hook me up because I took care of Stained before Stained was the biggest band in the world. So, and anytime, even when Stained wasn't doing interviews, she would get me an interview, you know, because, you know, I just was always took care of my label clients and the radio stations. So I built those relationships, and because the column was so popular and people always wanted to get their band mentioned in it, you know, and CMJ was acquired and they got a big cash infusion, and I asked them if I could build a spins chart because I would get more advertising from it, I'd spent a year researching and developing, and I built a spins chart, which is what they told me the only way that CMJ would have more value is if it had that. So I went out and created that, and it was very, very risky at the time because CMJ wasn't known for that, and some commercial stations didn't want to report because they're like, oh, it's going to make our station value go down because it's a college magazine. And I said, listen, only the A-est of the A-list stations can report to this chart. So that's basically what I did. And, you know, while I was there, that's basically, you know, I managed to grow it by, you know, generating advertising revenue.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
Yeah, it was definitely, it was a labor of love. You know, it was the best job. I've got flown all over the country to go to shows, to see a band, for showcases, to cover things. It was definitely a very, very finger on the pulse time, ear to the underground. And it'll never be replicated. You know, I have every column I ever wrote in date order saved.
Whoa.
Because, you know, and you'll see, like, I'll see when I look at it, that I was the first person to write about a lot of bands before they blew up. Linkin Park, POD, all those bands.
Really?
Yeah, I was seeing those bands, like I said, at like 500, 200, 300 capacity venues before anybody else did. And Perfect Circle is another example. Like, I got a platinum record for them because I was one of the first people to cover them.
That's amazing. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Wow, your wall must be something to talk about.
It is nice. My friend, not my friend. Well, he is my friend too, but he's my handyman at my house. He, you know, he hangs everything because he has like a good vision. And if I try to hammer the wall, it's going to crack the plaster, you know, or the drywall or whatever, the sheet or whatever it is. I don't even know what it is. So he, you know,
plaster or sheetrock.
And he envisioned it being, you know, the rock wall, as he calls it. And he hung everything up there and it's, yeah, a bunch of gold records. You know, I still have a couple that I haven't put up yet.
Wow, super cool. That is very cool. All right, before we go any further into that, we'll go back up a minute. Why? Why have you gone completely off the deep end at such a young age, gone insane for writing for music? Like, where did this start?
Oh, there's why was I? There's the generic question. I knew what I wanted to do. Like, while all my friends in college were like, oh, we're going to go party, we're going to do this, I think a lot of them always looked at me as like, oh, there's boring Amy, but I wasn't doing anything boring. I was going to heavy metal shows. I was going to see Fear Factory and Starkweather and Morbid Angel at the Trocadero and getting to meet them and getting to talk to them, getting free merch and free tickets. That was like, I don't need to go drink at some bar. Like, you guys have fun doing that. You know, I knew that was what I wanted to do. And I started, like, most people's first concert was like Lollapalooza or like, you know, Warped Tour. My first concert was Kiss, you know, with my brother. It took me when I was like four. You know, wow. And I was, you know, in kindergarten, like, you know, I used to draw pictures of Brian Johnson from AC/DC. And like my prayer, I went to Catholic school my whole life. And in first grade, I had a prayer partner and they asked me, like, do you like music? Because they used to come down and you would say prayers with them and they would talk to you like from the eighth grade. Uh-huh. I was in first grade. I remember this girl, Donna Briody, her name was. And she was like, do you like music? I was like, yeah. She's like, well, what do you like? And I was like, I like AC/DC, Kiss, and Iron Maiden. And she was like, oh my God, I have the coolest prayer partner ever. Because she was like a metalhead.
Oh, and she like, oh, okay. I thought you were going to tell me she like ran out of the room screaming.
No,
okay.
She was like, I have the best prayer partner ever, but she likes metal, you know? And
that's great.
And then I went to see AC/DC, and I remember my mom took me, and my brother was on the floor with his friends, and my mom was sitting up in the like, you know, the rafter seats with me. And I was sitting on the end and I was singing like She's Got the Jack, which is more of an album track. And the people, like these young metalheads across the aisle from me, asked my mom if I could come sit with them because they thought I was cool because I had my little pigtails and my AC/DC shirt and I was singing She's Got the Jack. So my brother, I attribute it all to my oldest brother. He was a huge metal and rock fan, Van Halen, Aldo Nova. You know, he was the one, you know, Journey. He got me into all that stuff. So
right on.
Yeah, I started really young with liking music, and I was always going to shows. I've probably been to maybe 3,000 shows in my lifetime.
Wow.
Yeah, back when I was at CMJ, I was going to sometimes 3 shows a night, you know, and it was like, oh, Among Thieves is playing at Coney Island High at 2 in the morning. No problem. I'll go see them. You know, I always look back and I go, what was I thinking? I wasn't. I was 22 and having a great time.
Yeah, that's definitely the way to go, because I know dating a girl at college, a writer actually, right around what year is this?
What
when you were talking about going to all these shows and everything?
Oh, that was like 98 to 2000.
Yep. I was dating a girl at Rider University right around that time, and it was like I drove all the way out there and it was like, doesn't anyone want to not get drunk and go see Typo Negative? Anybody? You know, like, I met her at the Typo show, and it was like, I'm not drunk either. We're probably the only two idiots here, but right. Cool. And like, oh God, it was like, that's all they wanted to do. And it was like, that's fine. Once in a while, it's fun. But like, there's so many good shows 20 minutes away. Let's go do something else. And
yeah, my Friday night was like, oh, Snapcase is at the Track. I'll see you guys later. Bye. You know,
hell yeah.
Like, that was what I wanted to do, you know. And I remember when I was interning at FMQB, this girl Teresa, who worked there, you know, I went to a show to interview some band of the Toy Dolls, and I let her ask questions, and she was like, "I thought you were the coolest person ever because you let me ask questions." She invited me to her wedding too, and I went, and it was awesome because when I first met her, she wasn't that nice to me, and then when it was just because she just had a very curt like way about her, and it wasn't that she was rude, she was just curt, and I was like, "Oh, I don't like her, she's rude." And then she was like, "I met up with her at the show, and I let her ask questions." During the interview, and you would have thought that I, you know, gave her favorite, you know, candy.
Right. That's awesome. I love it. That's a cool story. I love the Kiss 4-year-old pigtail thing. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and I had a
or AC/DC, or
AC/DC shirt on, and you know, mm-hmm. I think that was maybe 6 at that point. I don't remember the exact dates.
I'm going with 4. I think 4 is cooler.
Yeah.
I can't get my kids into it.
Journey with Steve Perry. What's that?
I can't get my kids into it. I have three kids and they listen to garbage and I'm so upset about it. Like my son was starting to go down the path of Mastodon and Iron Maiden and I was like, yes, I got him, my firstborn son. And then all of a sudden he just went like, I listen to what all the other kids in class listen to. And he's like, yeah, he's I don't like metal anymore.
I my nephews him. And nieces are like that a little bit too. I remember my nieces, who they're on their 20s now. I remember like at Roadrunner when I worked there, I remember when our sales head of sales was like, what are they into? What are your like nieces? I'm like, dude, they like Chris Brown and all that Rihanna bullshit. And it's like, my nephew is the one, he's 17 now. He was like, he likes Attila and he likes, you know, For Today. And he likes some of the harder stuff and We the Kings. Mm-hmm. So he went down more of the right road. And I remember, here's a funny, other funny story about getting kids into music. You know, my other nephew, Anthony, he's like 13 or no, he's like going to be 15 this year. And okay. One time he was hanging out with me at my dad's house. And he was like, you know, do you know this band Pierce the Veil? And I was like, excuse me. I was like, Pierce the Veil. Do I know Pierce the Veil? And I pulled up the Creepshow interview podcast that I had done with them. And I was like, do I know Pierce the Veil? And I show it, and he sees me sitting there talking to him. He goes, oh, you talked to Vic from Pierce the Veil? And he was like, it was just cute because it was like his mind was totally blown. And to me, it's just, that's just my job. You know, it's, I don't look at it the same way that, you know, right. other people do.
Mm-hmm. That's neat. Let's go down that path for a while. Knowing as much as we haven't even gotten into everything that you've done, and we're probably not going to be able to get into everything you've done because this I can't have a 7-hour episode. But
yeah, that's true. People might get bored.
You've done it all. I mean, you've done it all. Like wrote a book. You've done it all. Like worked at Sirius. You've done it all.
Yeah, I did. I was on Sirius, you know, for like 2 or 3 years, and on Liquid Metal when it was called Heart Attack.
Uh-huh. You don't, no one listening, no one owns an album that you didn't, like somebody has something in their collection that you had something to do with. Like you're in liner notes, you're in thank yous, you were part of Slipknot crew, like from ground up, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, they're family to me. I don't look at them as work, they're family.
Right, there you go. So since you've seen it all, kind of from the beginning, from the inception of everything, isn't it interesting where podcast is taking everything? Like, what are your opinions on what, I mean, you're on one right now, not that mine's a big deal. And I'm not saying that to be like facetious or anything, but like, seriously, where do you see podcasts fitting in?
It's like an untapped market, honestly. Like, I feel like for a while there, I wasn't at Roadrunner. We weren't really supposed to work with them because of the legislation with the royalties had not caught up to the technology, you know? And it was like,
no, I don't know. What does that mean?
There was just that there was a way where we couldn't send music to podcasts because they weren't paying royalties on it at the time. So we weren't allowed, you know, interviews could be done. We just weren't allowed to let them play music.
Got it.
So that became challenging. But, you know, I do work with a lot of podcasts, you know, while doing PR. And I listen to a lot of them. I like to listen to like a lot of true crime ones, and not just saying because I like Serial. I mean, that's just what's up my alley in terms of true mm-hmm. crime. But, you know, I see it as an untapped market. Like we really try to place Jesse Leach from Killswitch into a lot of those because he has such a cool lifestyle vibe. And, you know, I'm working on getting Mike D from Killswitch, who's a huge wrestling fan, to do some of the, you know, wrestler podcasts because it's just a whole new untapped world to like dive right into and just to spread the band. And the band's name and the band recognition outside right. of, you know, the usual suspects.
Right on. I love it. That's kind of where I'm hoping to go with it. I don't know what I'm doing with this thing, honestly. I'm just talking.
I like podcasts because you can listen to them whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely great because I know for a while there I got very much into XM before they transitioned into Sirius and a little bit after they got into Sirius too. But it was like with the job that I had, it was jump in and out of the truck, and it was like, oh my God, I want to hear what they're going to say, but I got to run this delivery up there, and I'm like standing halfway between the two, and I'm like, I have it right. turned up so loud that I want to hear it from the truck, and then you start belting out all these curse words. I'm like, ah, customers are going to call it. Like, it got frustrating. Now I love being able to just be like, click, I'll come back to that later. And
yeah,
and
of course.
Yeah, I love it. All right, circle back around here. I'm just going off of the... a lot of times I just use Wikipedia as a guideline because people have so much stuff and it usually is put right in chronological order for me. But your about page on Atom Splitter is jaw-dropping unbelievable. I can't believe you did all this stuff. I had no idea that you wrote a book called Do the Devil's Work for Him, How to Make It in the Music Business and Stay in It. I know nothing about it. Can you tell me about it?
About the book?
Yeah.
Well, I co-wrote it with one of my really good friends, Rick Florino. He's a really, really brilliantly talented fiction writer. And we decided I was dating somebody in LA for like 3 years, and I was in LA like every 6 weeks, and sometimes he did a radio show in Riverside, California. So sometimes on Saturday nights he would have to go do his radio show, and because I was there, Rick would drive to Anaheim from Los Angeles and pick me up, and then we would just go into LA and do stuff, you know, because I was there. And one night we got Pinkberry and we were like, we should write a book. And it was his idea, and he was like, let's do something that could be like a definitive textbook in like a music industry course. It's something we both know. And that's basically what we did. And we just wrote it back and forth, and we just emailed each other chapters. And I look at it now, and it sorely needs to be updated, because it's feels like very cusp of the millennial, you know, digital iPad, iPhone, born with one in their hand generation. Mm-hmm. You know, it definitely needs an upgrade. But we wrote it, and somebody I had worked with at CMJ told me he would publish anything I ever wrote. So he published that for us. You know, we really pumped it hard. We had a publicist for it. I did speaking engagements at my college. So did he. And, you know, we feel like it's really like, you know, people still contact me about purchasing it on like Amazon. I haven't seen like any money from it in years, but it was definitely a labor of love as well. And we really enjoyed doing it, and we were able to kind of do it really easily. And it was something that, you know, I didn't really have to think of. I just like typed and everything I thought came out. So it was definitely, it tried to teach people like the basics, like doing a solid, how to look out for people, how to be professional, how to, you know, the difference between being persistent and being a punisher, which, you know, punishers will never even know. I always say this, when I post on Facebook about somebody being a punisher, the punisher will like it have no idea, ironically or not, that I'm talking about them, because they just don't, they can't read the room, so to speak. They don't have any idea that they're being a punisher. And I tried to distill all that information into the book, you know. A lot of times people ask me, how'd you get your start? I'm like, honestly, it's all in the book, and I'm not, the book's like 10 bucks, you know what I mean? I'm not trying to say it, but everything, the reason, honestly, the impetus for writing that was that I got asked that question so many times, I got tired of answering it. I was like, let's just put it in a book.
Right. Yeah. Just start publishing answers in a pamphlet, and you get the same question over and over again.
I really feel like it could be just a definitive textbook, though, for a music industry course. That's the vision I had for it.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody ever utilize it as such that you know of?
No, I don't, and I wish that they did. You know, I think it needed to probably go to a bigger publishing house in order for something like that to happen. But, you know, and it's funny, just like to kind of almost circle back, the title came from when I was applying for those jobs at CMJ. You know, I sent them writing samples, and when I saw that there was a job opening, I emailed one of the people who worked there, this girl Kelso, and I said, hey, I'm going to send my resume in. Do you have any recommendations? Should I send samples of my writing, or should I wait for them to ask? And she wrote me back and said, yeah, you got to do their work. Do the devil's work for them. Don't make them ask you to send samples. Send the samples. You know, she's like, do the work for them. Don't make them have to come back to you with any questions. And that's where the title came from. And that's how I truly believe that's how you make it in the music industry, by, you know what, doing more and doing it better. You know, you can't. Yeah. This is such a competitive, difficult industry to break into. So if you're not maximizing and making yourself stand out, then you're not doing yourself any favors.
And that's where the title came from. To push it further into the digital, I'm not going to pretend at all to know what I'm talking about. I'm channeling Seth Werkheiser through me right now. But you're talking about doing the hard work back when it took time to like send samples, lick, stamps, mail shit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Nowadays, it's literally just include a link and people still don't.
No, it's really, you'd be surprised at how lazy people are. You know, even after I started my own business, you know, I applied for a job because the Philadelphia Flyers had a PR job open, and it was a job I could have done in my sleep. And I said, you know, I'm going to mail my resume in addition to uploading it. I'm going to mail it to everybody in a marketing capacity there. And I did. I mailed it to like 7 people, and I printed it out on orange paper because, you know, Flyers are orange and black. And I wrote it, you know, an orange black marker on the envelope. So I just felt that would always stand out. And anytime I had a job interview, like I would send the interviewer like nuts afterwards and say, you're nuts if you don't hire me. You know what I mean? Stuff like that. And people, that's how people remember you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember somebody sent, some kid getting out of a college radio station sent a bunch of promoters packs of ramen noodles and said, I don't want to eat these for the rest of my life. Please hire me. I mean, how do you don't forget that, you know?
Right.
So you have to be creative and stand out. And people don't realize, like, I was saying the other day, I get emails. Hi, can I interview the band? What band? I have 50 bands. Who do you want? You know, who are you and who do you want to talk to? It's not a matter of going, oh, you want to talk to this band here? No, no, it's a matter of there's a protocol and a checklist. And if you don't fit the checklist and the criteria set forth by the band and manager, you're not doing the interview. But if you can't even tell me who you want to interview, that tells me you're not a professional.
Sure. What's like the one thing that like I know you get a lot of annoying things, like you just said, can I interview the band? Can you be more vague? You know, what's the one thing that you see for people that you think should be acting professional? And when you see it, it just absolutely runs the nails down the chalkboard where you're like, how are you not getting this yet?
It's just when people like don't take no for an answer. I'd hate to see those people on dates. You know, it's scary.
Oh yeah. Gross.
You know, no means no. When did no not mean no? Like, I told you that the band is not available. I don't have to explain why. I know what the rules are. And then people try to tell you, well, and they try to talk you out of it. Or they try to tell you that, like, they know better. Like, I'm not saying no because I feel like it or for my health. I'm saying no because I've been given a list of 5 or 10, 15, 3, 70, whatever criteria for the band doing interviews. And if you don't meet them all, you're not getting the interview. It has nothing to do with you. It has to do with a set of predetermined, you know, guidelines set forth by the manager and the band. And I write a column on Sonic Bids about this all the time. People just get it really, you know, when people get rude about it and think it's personal and it's not. Oh, well, you know, I remember a long time ago, a weekly publication that doesn't exist anymore. The editor contacted me and was like, I'd like to interview Nickelback on this tour. I said, well, you know, they're not doing any interviews anymore. And that was just because they were getting trashed in the press so much that they said, we're not doing interviews on this tour. We're not doing anything. We don't care who it is. We're not doing it. And at that point, they didn't need to do it. I would have liked them to do it to keep, you know, to continue to make friends in the media, but they didn't want to do anything because they were just getting trashed. And this woman sent me an email. She's like, oh, Chad doesn't want to interview with me. You know what? Screw him. And when he's on the way down, I'm going to remember that and I'm not going to do an interview with him and he's going to be sorry. And I said to her flat out, and I was like, I'm not going to mince words here, Linda. I was like, listen, Chad Kroeger could never do another interview in his life. And he will wipe his ass with $100 bills till the day he dies. So he's not going to see you on the way down and beg you to interview him. Thanks. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
right.
Like, you know, I tried to explain to her the band is not doing press. The band is on a press blackout. And I was being honest and just not revealing all the information. I just said they're on a press blackout. And when somebody tries to tell you like, oh, well, you just don't want to give me this interview and they're assholes. That's not the case. You know what I mean?
Right. Okay.
You don't know
okay.
What goes
I do
on
now.
Behind those closed doors.
Yeah, people take things too personally and they don't realize that
it had nothing to do with her. It had everything to do with the band wasn't doing media interviews, and that's it.
Gotcha. He could wipe his ass with $100 bills. Yeah, they did okay, huh?
Yeah, I had great dental insurance for many, many years because of it. And you know what? I think they write great songs. I have nothing but positive things to say about Nickelback.
I don't really care for their musical style, but I love that they
Truckers
provided...
Truckers and strippers love it.
Say what?
Truckers and strippers all across the tires.
Whatever. Hey, they need music too. But I love hearing that they did so well that they helped you get dental insurance. They probably paid some bills. They helped people keep jobs.
They kept the lights on. And we were able to sign bands like Killswitch Engage and, you know, Trivium and lots of bands that we signed or wrote on our Gojira because Nickelback really had a, you know, nice infusion of cash and we broke the band huge and we were able to continue to function as a very successful label.
So that just speaks to something that I always seem to be talking about with people. If you don't like something, just don't listen.
Yeah,
don't buy it. You don't have to go on and trash or anything because we know that you're just way cooler than the Nickel, you know, you don't like Nickelback and that's fine. And you love Gojira and that's great. Now you fit in with that crowd. But, you only know about Gojira because of Nickelback, and I bet you didn't even know that.
Right,
so,
exactly.
I mean, I didn't know that. You just taught me that. So that's like, if you don't like it, just, okay, cool. Just don't mention it, you know. Just support what you like. You don't have to go on and shit on what you don't like because there's plenty of that out there. Twitter is already clogged with it.
And people would always tell me, like, oh, you can't like this. Well, actually, I do. Like, I took the job at Roadrunner as Nickelback was breaking because I wanted to be a part of something huge, you know, and I knew it was going to be, you know, I wanted to work with Slipknot. I wanted to work with Glasshall. I wanted to work with Killswitch and I wanted to work with Nickelback, you know, it's like, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be successful and wanting to be a part of something and running to your desk every day because you're watching a band break, you know, I got to see that happen for many years with Killswitch Engage and I can't say that, you know, I've had prouder moments than that.
That's awesome. Wow. Yeah. You're there from the ground up with Killswitch. That's amazing.
Yeah, the first record, Alive or Just Breathing. Well, the first record for Roadrunner, Alive or Just Breathing, came out on my birthday.
No kidding.
It was my first year at Roadrunner, too. It was one of my first major records. And it was, like I said, I wanted to work Slipknot, Glassjaw, and Killswitch. And I, you know, I got to work Machine Head, and I got to work with Fear Factory and Max Cavalera for a dozen records, and so many great bands, Trivium and Gojira through the years, that I look back and I was a very blessed person that I got to work with bands that I loved. And there was a lot of people who come to work and be like, I don't get this music. And they would ask me, like, hey, you know, what do you love about this? Because we lived it. I remember Monty Connor and I would always be in meetings and just be like, we live this. We know this is good because we love and we live this. And I was very lucky to work there for 12 years and worked with a lot of great, great bands that mean a lot to a lot of people, myself included.
You got started at Roadrunner right around. I was a huge, 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 huge Fear Factory fan at the time they came in. Yeah.
I worked with them on like their last record. Like I always say, like, I was in the phase when like all those bands were cycling out Cold Chamber, Fear Factory, Spine Shank, Typo Negative, Sepultura. All those bands were cycling out, but bands like Killswitch and Devil Driver and Slipknot and Trivium were all cycling in. So I was, you know, I got to work with some of the old guard bands, and I got to work with bands that I helped to establish. And
right.
Like I said, there's really no feeling is quite as rewarding.
Demanufacture was one of the
classic records. Radio at Roadrunner, I would produce these radio shows, and I would commandeer like an hour of like specialty shows across the country. I would produce them and send them out. So like the host of the show would like, I would, you know, pitch it, and they'd be like, yeah, we'll do it if you can produce it. And what I would do is I would record it in a little ghetto setup at one of the open cubicles. So I would do that, and then I would record it, and I would play like classic Roadrunner stuff and send them giveaway copies of even classics like The Manufacturer or Roots and stuff like that. So even though I was working the current releases, I still got to work some of the classics.
Very cool. Very cool. The first time I ever saw Iron Maiden was opening for Fear Factory on the Demanufacture tour with Blaze Bailey as a vocalist.
Oh, wow.
That was mind-bending. And I play drums, and this tall dude who kind of looked like Raymond Herrera walked over next to me and was watching Iron Maiden. It was Raymond Herrera. So I shit my pants. And I was like, will you sign my ticket stub? It was probably, when was that whole thing?
I was like 95-ish, maybe?
Okay, I'll go with that, yeah. And I remember standing in Philly with him, and I just remember just kind of standing there. Like, we both had our arms crossed. We both had, like, that disapproving look on our face. But it was funny because, like, he could have rested his elbow on top of my head. He's so much taller than me.
That tall.
He's a big dude, yeah, and I'm not. So it was just funny because I just remember kind of leaning towards him and he was leaning towards me and we both looked at each other. And I looked up and he looked down and we both had like that, like it's...
Yeah, scratching the beard.
Just Blaze, I love you, but look at the impossible shoes you're trying to fill. It's just not happening, man.
Let's call this charade off while we can.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we miss Bruce. So he just kind of flashed me this look like, yeah, you get it. And signed my ticket stub and walked backstage. And I was just like, hell yeah, that just happened. And my buddy was like, how do you do that? I was like, I don't know. I don't know. He found me. He almost tripped over me. He's so tall. But that was a cool... I haven't thought about that since it happened, man. That was cool.
Funny similar story, not as, you know, I remember once when I was seeing Tool at Ozfest, I think maybe it was like 98 or something, and I was standing watching Tool, and like this is kind of like a VIP area, and I looked next to me, I'm like, who's this guy with the red Yankees hat standing? Oh, it's Fred Durst, and he's rocking out to Opiate just as hard as I am. And it was just very interesting to see Fred Durst from Limp Bizkit, you know, enjoying a moment of Tool with him, because he loved Tool, and everyone looked at him as like he was some big mook, but he actually had pretty good musical taste.
How about that?
Yes.
I remember seeing that too. That would have been Ozfest.
98, maybe.
I think 98, because I saw 97 with, Fear Factory and all that and everything.
Amazing, all those bands. That was a very Roadrunner-centric Ozfest.
Yeah. Oh, man, it's crazy. How old are you?
Me? I'm 41. I just turned 41. Seth and I actually have the same birthday.
That's right. He told me that. You heard about his whole fiasco that I we got him a tattoo and all that.
Yes.
That was awesome. Happy birthday. I totally forgot that he mentioned that. Yeah, you're 1 year older than him.
He tried to jack my birthday. It was mine first though.
Yep, that's right. That's right. He can never take that from you. He'll never catch you. Anybody can go to Adam Splitter PR and see the virtual wheelbarrow shit ton of everything that you've been involved with. Music, blah, 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 bands, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. We get it. All kinds of crazy stuff on here. Like, you're involved in fashion and beauty.
Yeah. I write in the mornings. Like, I write for Bustle. It's a female, it's a women's interest site. Huge traffic. One of the top, 1,000 sites on the web with ranking. I write, about shoes and lipsticks and stuff like that. And I just love it. I'm very into fashion and beauty. I always have been. And I've been doing that for about 10 years too. And it's just like, you know, like they, I always say like in Little Miss Sunshine, they say, love what you do, fuck the rest. So I always tried to parlay things I loved into jobs, you know, my house looks like Sephora because I get so much samples of stuff, you know, and some I donate to my friends, I use them, or I donate to women at a pantry, you know, if it's something that, you know, is going to go bad, you know, women who are looking for jobs. So I always try to parlay that as well. And
sure.
But most of the time I wind up keeping a lot of the stuff because it's sent directly to me. And, you know, it's a lot of stuff that I want to write about and like and share with the world and give women an honest assessment because they're going to go spend their money on it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I love writing about fashion too. I'd like to, you know, I don't make my own clothes, but I mess around with them and cut them and stuff like that. And you know, I'm very interested in that. And my biggest passion right now, though, I said is my work with dogs. You know, my friend Rick, who I wrote the book with, was like, you know, you're just doing too much work all the time. You're always working. He goes, you need to do something where you're not involved in writing or publicity or handling something related to bands. He's like, you love dogs. Why don't you just go work at a dog shelter on weekends and walk dogs or something? And I was like, yeah, that's a great idea. And I contacted the shelter near where I grew up. And they were like, yeah, you can come walk one dog a week, 10 dogs a week, 10 dogs a day, whatever you want. And I made a commitment. I was only going to do it on Saturdays for like 4 hours. And now I do it Saturday and Sunday because it's truly the best, probably about 10 hours of my week. Because when I'm out with the dogs, I don't think about anything else. I don't check emails. I take photos of me and the dogs because I'm trying to get them adopted. You know,
sure.
I love being with them. It's very relaxing. It takes my mind off stress and work. And it's great companionship. And it's also helping. It's good for their souls, but it's better for mine. Like, it's like the fact that I can help a dog feel better and feel loved and get exercise and get out of their kennel and see what the people are really good. And despite whatever their situation was that got them there. To me, right. That's like being that bridge is the best thing. It's the best feeling when I see a dog I love get adopted. You know, that makes true happiness. You know, like it's tough. It's very emotional. It's very tough sometimes because there's circumstances that you can't control. And, you know, I've grown to love maybe 10 dogs in the past couple of years as much as I love my own dog, Higgins, and I wanted to bring them home. But, you know,
you're going to be crazy dog lady if you're not careful.
Oh yeah. I want to move into a house. I own a condo. I would like to have a house so I could have like 10 dogs, you know, and people are like, what would Higgins do? Because me and Higgins are so tight. I'm like, please, he's looking for a brother. So he can be like, mom, see you later. We're going to go play, you know? So
right.
Like, I would just love to just have, you know, I've transported dogs to their foster homes and, you know, it makes me, it's my calling. I know it's my calling in life to work with dogs because you see a lot and you see, I tell people this all the time, not to get all sappy, but, you know, I've learned more about survival and about strength from the dogs that I work with than any human could ever teach me because those dogs come in some pretty bad conditions or they're dumped off or they're forgotten about. And some of them come in from really bad situations in Camden. And you know what? 2 seconds later, they're licking your face. They don't lose faith in people. And to me, that's a powerful lesson. You know,
yes, it is.
It makes me happy to be there. You know, like on holidays, I go and walk dogs. Like on Black Friday, I'll spend my whole day there just walking dogs, giving them their treats, cleaning out kennels. I don't care. I'm not above any of that. Because you truly, truly can appreciate and love and want to help something when you see what situations they're in. And the shelter, like I say all the time, when people come in, I tell them, listen, not to be a downer. I'm just trying to tell people, like, go adopt. But when people come in, they get sad. And I go, no, please. These dogs, they're getting meals. The volunteers are bringing in baked chicken for them. I said, my dad makes chicken every weekend, and I bring it to the dogs. And he's always like, oh, let me season this up so it tastes better for them. You know, he would give them filet mignon if he was cooking that. You know, they have people who love them, take them out. We give them baths. The shelter staff loves them. So they're it's not ideal. It's not optimal, but they're in a situation that's better than being on the street or being abused. So,
right.
You know, it's just hard to see them because you look at their eyes and you're like, I want to take them home.
Yeah, I know. My wife is kind of pushing for a second dog because she thinks our first dog needs a friend. And I'm just like, oh my God, I just don't want the responsibility and the vet bills. And I want to do the right thing by not,
exactly.
You know, like I love children. Great. I don't want to have 20 of them. You know what I mean? Like. I love my dog. I don't.
Because some people go and get a dog and they go, I don't want to do all this or it's too expensive. Like, you make the responsibility and the commitment. You can't just take it back. But unfortunately, yeah, you can. And a lot of people can do that. I personally would never be able to walk away from a dog and be like, oh my God, be like, who is with my dog right now? You know, and there's been situations, you know, people don't always tell the truth about why they're giving up their dogs. And I understand people have situations that might preclude them from, but I'd be living in a box before my dog went anywhere.
Right. Yeah, I heard. I have a friend who has a situation where I think I'll get it right. It was kind of like, yeah. This dog's fine. And then they got it home, and it was just like seizures. It needs medication.
Yeah,
it
that happens too.
Can't control itself. It has bowel issues and everything, and it's just wrecking the house. And they're constantly dealing with the headache of it. And it's like guaranteed to come home from work and dealing with piss and shit on the floor. And it's just like, it's a total bummer that they pawned that kind of a dog off on somebody the way that they did. But at the same time, the dog needed a home. I don't know where my politics are on that. I kind of feel like it was a little bit deceitful the way that it was given to them. But everybody wants that perfect puppy that has nothing wrong with it, right?
Yeah, and they don't, like, people come in all the time. Where are the small dogs? Where are the small dogs? Well, usually small dogs are at breeders, because most of the time, you know, small dogs usually don't end up in shelters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the small dogs, I find, you know, they have a lot of personality, but they're also small, so they also have bigger voices. You know, I work not exclusively.
Oh, that's a good point.
Well, it's true, you know, people want small dogs, but, you know, I find them, like, and I mean this in a loving way, that the smaller dogs are the bigger assholes, you know, because they're like, you know, they want to assert their toughness. It's like almost Napoleonic. But I work, not exclusively, but I work really a lot with a lot of pit bulls, because that tends to be what ends up in the shelter. And I can't, you know, I'm ashamed of being an Eagles fan during the Michael Vick era, because I still wore Eagles clothes and I still had an Eagles leash and collar on my dog even when Michael Vick was there. And I look back now, and having worked so closely with dogs, I'm ashamed that he was on the Eagles when I see what
that was hard.
What he did with dogs. And
that was hard.
I'm ashamed that I did not give up my season tickets when he was on the team, you know, but I can only move forward. But
yeah,
you know, I feel like I do so much work with dogs now, and pit bulls, honestly, I think they're one of the most wonderful breeds. I've had, you know, 115-pound dogs sitting on my lap and licking my face as if, like, we were in a relationship, you know what I mean? So, right. You know, so, and it's a wonderful breed, and I like to do whatever I can to educate people about it. It's almost mm-hmm. like doing PR. That's why I post dogs on my Facebook all the time. Some people are like, oh, you post too much dog stuff. Then unfollow me. Delete me. Bye. You know what I mean? Not going to miss you, because I post that stuff because I'm trying to help homeless animals find their families. And I'm never going to stop doing that. So if people don't like it, later.
I love how passionate you are about it, too. That's awesome.
I really am. It's really, really, really important to me, because, you know, I've learned so much from these dogs about survival, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and some of them have a lot of personality. There are some dogs that I can get in their kennel with them and they will sit with me and then there's other dogs that you have to work with and you have to gain trust with them, or you have to learn how to trust them. You know, I've learned how not to give up on another being because of that. There was a couple of dogs that were real tough and I was like, God, if I don't take them out, I don't know if somebody else is. Okay, so I can't give up on them. I have to, like, work through it. You know, the fact that they might be a little stubborn or they might give you a little whale eye, I just have to learn how. It has taught me how to be a little bit more resilient as well, and how to not give up on something because it's hard.
Did you say whale eye?
Whale eye, yeah, it's something dogs do. It's like,
what does that mean?
They look, it's like side eye. They look at you out of the side of their eye. And usually that means they're going to bark at you or snap. So,
oh,
it's just like a protective thing. It's a protective measure. You know, I've luckily never been bitten. I've only had like a couple bumps and bruises because a dog might have been playing with me and they might have accidentally nipped me or whatever.
Right. But
whale eye, you know, I've seen dogs give it to other people.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I never heard the term whale eye before. Yeah, I just learned something. Yeah. My dog gives me that when she's playing, and she kind of has, she's 16 pounds. I could set her on a football team and kick her over the neighbor's house, but, but she's so little and she gets like that. Come on, look on her face. And she does that thing out of the side. And then if you're not careful, she does the paw thing and she's already scratched her faces, like totally like horsing around, but she's already like hurt us because she kind of gives you that little, like that, you know, we always called it like the look from the side. And next thing you know, she just pounces. And she's so friggin' small and so fast that you're like laying on the floor thinking you're gonna play with her. Next thing you know, she's got two paws up the top of your face and she's coming down your eyes with it, totally horsing around and playing. And you're like, damn, I didn't even get a chance to respond and get out of the way. And she like hurt one of my kids because it was like an accident. No, oh, she scratched my face.
It's usually always.
Dude, they're so fast sometimes.
Yeah, you can't. Sometimes, you know, you gotta be like, you know, they can be sneaky with their paws and with their move.
So did this dog passion thing, I'm dismissing it like it's something small. Did this come later in life, or did you grow up with dogs?
No, I always grew up with dogs, you know, and I always wanted to have
What kind
dogs.
Did you have?
We had Scottish Terriers when I was growing up.
And
we
oh, my God, had I love
American
them.
Bulldog. And then, you know, we had cats too, but I also my brother always had pit bulls, and for a few years I lived in an apartment and I couldn't have a dog. You know, we couldn't have because of the rules, which I think are stupid anyway, because dogs are well-behaved, and babies at times, or toddlers, or children, but
Yeah, you know, I agree. I have both, and you're right.
Trying to be diplomatic, but I find my dog is probably more well behaved than children that live in this building, and it's just like he's always here. I just always wanted. It's just always good to have a dog around. They're great companions. They make you. They know once they can intuit when things are up, and they know like when I'm upset or I'm like stressed out about something, he'll come and like sit next to me. It's almost like a comforting measure. So,
right.
I've always loved dogs. I've always been a dog person.
Me too. Yeah, me too. Hey, Seth, cats are dumb. Dogs. I always tease Seth too. Cats are dumb. He's like, no, they're not. Stop it.
I like cats and I don't want to ever see anything.
I do too. I'm just busting his chops. Yeah, I'm just busting his chops. Cool. I think we're bringing this thing in for a landing. Adam Splitter is amazing. I can't believe how many people are involved with Adam Splitter. Because on the website, it looks like you are managing 7,000 people.
Well, yeah, it's me. I, run the show, but Seth works for me as well. He does my back end and with my website and my reporting for clients, keeps our press kit records, and he does my social media. And then I always have a tour press assistant that helps me with tour press. And right now I have Leah doing that. And for a while, for a year, I had someone named Brenda who worked for me, and she really helped me, get to that point where I was like, okay, this is just me to this is actually a thing that needs to be more than just me. So that was a big, huge step that I had to take, and a terrifying one at that, because there's tons of other consequences of that and positive consequences. But, it's just, making the commitment to be able to contract somebody and just doing all, the legalities of it and all that. It's very scary to take that step. And I did. And, I had a really great person that helped me get there. So, now I have Leah, who's awesome as well. So I always have people who want to intern. So it's right now it's three people, and I'm hoping to have some interns, in the fall as well. But yeah, and all of our clients are family, I've worked with Killswitch forever. I've worked with Attila forever. I work with For Today. We work with Chelsea Grin, I still work with Roadrunner with a bunch of up and coming bands, helping to develop them. And I work with all the Spine Farm bands. It's just very rewarding.
Wow. Love it.
Stressful. Oh, sometimes I want to carve a hole, like a hole in the wall. So I just put my head in it because sometimes I'm smashing my head in the wall, but I don't want to get a headache. So I kind of
good idea.
The same effect.
That's a good idea. It prevents you from hurting your knuckles too. It hurts. You accidentally always punch a stud and you're like, son of a bitch. How did I find
I'll
that
always,
thing?
I'll punch, like my friend Sammy at Revolver, she actually taught me how to like clench my fist to throw a punch and not hurt myself.
Good.
Which is actually probably a very good skill.
Coming useful. I mean, I hope you never need it, but it's good to know.
Yeah, hopefully I never need it. If somebody tries to accost me, I'll just boot them in the nuts.
Good move. That's why they're there. It's kind of like the big red button. I need to put you down. Bonk, right there. Well, two button. Never mind. We're not going to talk about it anymore. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. We'll get past the nut stuff. I wanted to end on one thing, but here on the website, there's one more thing. It says Amy's interviews every icon in rock music from members of Pearl Jam to Pantera, and it has also covered hip hop superstars like T.I. and Flo Rida and everything, which makes sense because it's still kind of connected to music, The next sentence, she also interviewed a variety of actors ranging from Nicolas Cage, Leonardo DiCaprio to Adrian Brody. What the hell? How? For what?
Oh, my God. I know.
You can't just flippantly throw that out there and expect people to be like, oh, yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio. No big deal.
I used to do interviews and press junkets for Artist Direct, which was like a movies, film, music, everything site. And I would cover all the East Coast like stuff. And, I would get to interview. You go to a hotel and you get to interview, Nicolas Cage about some stupid movie, And I got to interview Leonardo DiCaprio he was doing that movie Revolutionary Road. And I must say that he is even more distractingly attractive in person. It's like, no, I was like, I feel like I'm looking at a work of art here. And like, I almost couldn't ask questions because I was like, he's really probably the most handsome person I've ever laid eyes on.
He's really weak in the knees, good looking.
He's beautiful. He's like pretty flawless.
And he's not made up. He's not made up on camera. And then you see him and you're like, damn.
I looked at him and I was like, yeah, he's really very, very attractive. you know, unfairly. So, but yeah, I mean,
well, Amy, we have Leo DiCaprio on the call. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I used to do all those like press junkets, you know, and you get to interview. Sometimes you get one-on-one time. Sometimes you get like two questions in a room. You know, it's like cattle call. But yeah, I loved doing that. I wish I could have done more of it. You know, I used to get to go to a lot of movies. You know, go to screenings and stuff like that. But yeah, I used to do that like in late 2008.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
The thing I wanted to end on was in talking to Seth, he mentioned like, you know, you were really close to Slipknot, like even, you know, having a member pass away and everything, yeah. You were involved in that and everything.
The hardest professional day of my entire life dealing with
I can't even fathom. I to be that close to the people, they're not just clients, they have a family member. It's like losing a brother, I would imagine. But
well, I always tell people it was like very difficult for me because I was sent, when Paul passed away, I was sent to Iowa as the company's ambassador, not really even as publicist, as like the company, you know, the company's person to, you know, help them with whatever they needed because they were having that press conference. And
okay.
I remember saying like, I have to deal with my own sadness that somebody I cared about died, but I also have to deal with the fact that people who I consider family and brothers to me, which are the members of Slipknot, they are in pain right now. And that upsets mm-hmm. me. And I remember saying to somebody that I work with, actually the band's UK publicist who has worked with them, I remember saying, I'm like, the minute I see Corey Taylor, like, I'm going to lose it because he's an emotional bastard, you know? And I saw, it was, when I got to, you know, where the location where the press conference was, I saw, you know, one of their bodyguards and, you know, security guys. And I always see him, always on the road, always hanging out. And he was like, bring it in. He gave me a hug. And he just broke down and he was like 400 pounds, huge guy. And then as soon as I saw Corey's wife, I was like, I can't even talk to your husband right now. And she's like, he needs a hug. And as soon as I saw him, he walked up to me crying and I just was like broke down. I knew I couldn't, you know. It was hard. Oh, it was probably the hardest day because I had a, you know, somebody I cared about died and people I cared about were grieving and I wished I could have done more to help them.
Sure. And you still had to be like you're hurting, like, you're hurting on a per
you about it. I was like, yeah. And I'm like, MTV's interviewing me and I'm crying, you know. It was very hard.
Right.
It was very, very difficult. And I had people, I remember it was a BlackBerry at the time, texting me like, hold it together, hold it together. And I'm like, I'm trying. This is really hard.
Right. I can't.
it was the hardest professional, you know, because I remember when the news broke, I remember asking like our head of A&R, I'm like, dude, Rath, is this true? And he's like, yeah. And I'm like, what? And then like 2 minutes later, I was booking a flight to Iowa, you know?
So. Wow. Yeah, that wasn't even what I was going to ask you about, but thank you for saying all that. That's hard. I can't fathom what it's like to be like personally hurting, like the loss of a loved one, everybody involved in the band lost the loved one, so that hurts too, and you get to be the representative professional for the day.
Yeah, it was hard to put together. Yeah, that was definitely a challenge, you know. I wouldn't say worst, I just say toughest professional situation I ever dealt with. Oh, and I've had some tough ones.
Thanks for sharing that, because
staying and doing dumb shit.
and well, hey, if you have stories, this would be the place to dump them. But I mean, you don't have to get into it, because a lot of things that Seth was saying, like, I know Amy on a personal level, and she's told me things, and there's a couple aspects of stories I don't know if she'd want to get into or not, and everything. But he said, you know what I would like to hear though? He says, I'd like to hear what she says if you ask her if she has any good Glenn Danzig stories. I have a whole circle of friends that love Glenn Danzig. I'm not a huge fan, but Seth threw it out there, and I was like, "Why? What happened?" And he's like, "Just just ask Amy. I was like, all right.
Oh,
so,
my God, he yelled at me. I could tell you that story. But, I'm sure he didn't remember it the 5 seconds after it happened. But I interviewed him at a hotel in Manhattan, and I was super stoked, and I brought my 8x10 glossy photo. You know, a new one, too. It wasn't even like a classic Misfits or Mother-era photo. I was like, it's the new photo. He's promoting a new album. I'll get him to sign this. I mean, I remember beforehand, I was talking to my college boyfriend, Tom, who also got me into a lot of heavy music. Huge, huge Danzig fan, and like loved everything about Danzig. He's like, you're going to be in the same room with Danzig? He's like, oh my God. He's like, I can't believe this. So when I was interviewing him, and then after I was done, and I was like, Glenn, I'm like, I brought my 8x10, my glossy. Could you sign it? I'm totally being a geek. I'm being a nerd about this. He goes, oh, I got it. I'll sign it. I was like, I know. Thank you so much. I was like, I was kind of shy to ask you. I'm a total geek. I love you. But he goes, did you hear me? Did you hear what I said? You're not a geek. And I was like, okay, I'm sorry, Glenn. Like, he snapped at me and was like, kind of like, don't you listen to what I said? And I was like, okay, thanks. Glenn, I love you. Bye. It was just very, you know, he was like snippy. You know what I mean? He was like, I said, you know, I was like, okay, I'm just overcompensating, you know?
He pulled off the very rare, abrasive, angry compliment.
Yes. He like, you know, he was like trying to make me feel like it's okay. He was awesome for the interview, you know, but he was, you know, the kind of the Glenn that you see in here. Like, you know, he was just like, you know, like dismissive of me keep calling myself a geek because I was nervous.
he had enough.
Yes. He was like, bitch, did you hear me?
Whatever. Awesome story. Thanks for sharing that. I think people are really going to love hearing this. I love that we got so much of the dog stuff out there because I'm sure you talk about music all the time. No, screw it. Who cares? I'm sure it's music all the time with you. I mean,
I need a separation, and the dogs really help with that.
Yeah, that's what I want to talk to people about is the extra stuff that they don't get to talk about very often, you know, but this was awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. It's great. Any musical suggestions? I mean, you work with so many bands. Do you want to promote anybody or play a clip of music?
Well, my favorite record right now that I'm listening to that I think is quite possibly a perfect album is the new Gojira record, Magma. I just think it's awesome, and I'm working with them on their upcoming tour, and I worked with them before on Le Vent Sauvage, which I thought was a perfect record, and they outdid themselves again.
Wow, okay. Wow, that's a pretty ringing endorsement. Good. We went to see Gojira. Seth and I went to see them open for Mastodon in Sherman Theater. They were so good. I had no idea who they were. I never heard of them before.
They're perfect.
They're really good. They were really, really good.
They're one excellent of my favorite band. Bands I ever got to work.
Awesome. All right, I'll put some Gojira in here then. So that's that. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thanks for having me. I hope it is entertaining to whoever listens to it. Don't lock the door on me. You'll kill me face down dead. Another part of you is good to waste. Please hear me out. You'll kill me face down dead.
We're done. Go walk your dog.
As the story grows.
We love you. Take care. Bye-bye.